Join us for the Criterion Institute podcast as Joy Anderson, a global thought leader in business and social change, leads us through a series of discussions, interviews, frameworks, rants, and reframes that will help you better understand how to use finance as a tool for transformative systems change.
I am Joy Anderson, and this is the Criterion Institute podcast. Today, I'm reflecting in a couple of different ways on strategies for building movements. What are the ways that you go broad, and what are the ways that we go deep? So the first segment looks at the classic phrase, preaching to the choir. There's nothing wrong with preaching to the choir. But there's a tension between engaging with those who are already converted and bringing new people to the table. We need a bigger choir, but to do that, the choir needs to feel like a good place to be. It needs to sound good. I actually am a member of our choir, and I'll say that when we sound better, more people are attracted to joining the choir. So we need to be thinking about how to be a better choir. How do we support those who are showing up for this common task? How do we invest in those who are already doing the change work? After looking at this notion of preaching to the choir in a solo segment, my conversation with Sana Kabadia delves further into the nuances of working within mainstream systems, emphasizing the necessity of ongoing power analysis and thoughtful strategy development. Sana is an old friend, actually recently joined the board of Criterion. We are incredibly honored to have her as part of our governing board. I met Sana when she was working at GenderSmart with our dear friend, Suzanne Beagle. She went on to work at 2X and just took a new role in leading Heading for Change. In our conversation, we explore this delicate balance between incremental progress and transformative change, underscoring the importance of resilience, hope, and collaboration in advancing meaningful impact. I end with a short rant about excitement and the cost of excitement. This is another angle on going broader with audiences when they are experiencing new ideas. It's a little rant at those times when I'm told I shouldn't share an idea before it's ready. Again, back to the choir. Maybe we shouldn't be singing before we torture the audience. But it's funny, right? How much judgment we put into what's ready to share, who should we share, how should we share. So whether we're preaching to the choir or telling the choir that they should stop singing until they're ready, we all have lots of thoughts about who we should talk to and how. Honestly, most days, I'm just glad to be talking. So I'm recording this in November, which means that over the last 2 months, October and before that, September, it was conference season. Traveling from one conference to another, speaking on or listening to panels over and over again, right? It's kind of fun to really go out there and hear what everybody's thinking about, but there always is a moment at some point in a conference, either on the panel or in a breakout group, where somebody says, yeah, but they're talking to the choir, right? They're preaching to the choir, or some version of that same phrase. Now, I actually am a member of a choir. I'm the person who goes to church and listens to the sermon. I would dress up in that penguin suit, sing at the front of the church, and so I sit in the front of the church, and I am who they're preaching to. I am the one who shows up. But the critique when we're using this phrase in a field building or a conference activity is that we're talking to those already converted. We're talking to those already convinced. They are already doing impact investing. They are already investing with a gender lens. And so what is the purpose of talking to them since they're already doing this? We should focus on the work of bringing new people to the table. I will say that results in some fairly thin panels sometimes. One of the opening plenaries at a conference I went to was a case of an asset owner, a pension fund, I believe it was, who made a big announcement on their panel. As they were entering into this field of impact investing, they made a big announcement that said they will definitely, potentially, at some time, do something, but they're going to think about it a little longer. And that's really important for us all to understand how long they're thinking about this thing that they might do someday. We should also make announcements when somebody does something really well, not just when they discover the new approach to impact investing and are they converted. But we should also celebrate those who are just doing things well. There's this cool article in Harper's that a colleague of mine sent to me. It's a 2022 article, November 2020. And the article took on this idea of preaching to the choir and this assumption that it's most useful to be talking to those who disagree with us. And she was talking about it more from the perspective of politics and that we should be, you know, in the American phrase, we should be reaching across the aisle. But she says this, much of the evidence suggests that political organizations benefit most from motivating those who already agree with them. She continues, and that the Democrats in particular find the most success by pursuing people who don't know whether they'll vote rather than how they'll vote. I think this is actually brilliant and is relevant to the field of impact investing as well. The question of not just have they seen that they should be doing this, but are they actually doing this? And are they doing it well enough? The work of field building is about shaping a field. It's about building the practices. Gender lens investing and arguably impact investing itself have really only begun as fields. Our practices are not well-developed enough. There's a critical work to make this better. And that's what I love about being in a choir. At some point, every Thursday night for an hour, a group of us come together to sing. We're a group of people committed to the same task. And those choir people are often the people who do everything else as well. They're the ones who show up whenever there is a hand needed. We do need bigger choirs. I mean, in my little church, we could sometimes use a bigger choir, but we're mighty in our small size. We need a bigger choir, but to do that, the choir needs to feel like a good place to be. It needs to sound good. When our choir sounds good, we do a better job of attracting more people to say, ooh, that's a cool choir, I'll join your choir. So what we need to be thinking about is how do we build a better choir? How do we support those who are showing up for this common task? Invest in those who are moving forward this work and trying. But we also need to not assume that just because they're trying, their practices are fine. Honestly, we practice every Thursday night as a choir because if we didn't do that, we would suck as a choir. And so there is something about the words of encouragement, the focus, the attention put on those who are doing the work and pushing and practicing to do it better. And that's who we should be serving. So the question of broad versus deep, going pure versus working in the mainstream, right, Sana? These are choices that we're faced with all the time. What are some of those choices that are out there, and how do you navigate them?
Yeah, such a good question, Joy. These are things that keep me up because I think that as practitioners, as field builders, it's an eternal sort of question of, do you try and bring in those who are at the fringes of the ecosystem, or do you work with those who are at the epicenter because they're committed and they're ready to go and they just need more tools? And I think choice making, maybe us trying to choose, makes things too binary, because it's not like those at the fringes won't keep doing what they're doing anyway without our interventions. And so I think the answer to some of those choices is that it's not or, but it's an and. So it's okay to be both broad and deep. It's okay to start with small steps, but then kind of keep walking towards a more transformative path. And then there are times when I feel that maybe if you choose one or the other, you're also, I really ask myself if we're really, holding true to the rigor that we'd want for the field too. But most days I think it's an at, not an or.
I wonder though, because I find that organizations in general make a choice, right? Like I think about days in Gender Smart, right? Like the decision that you and I used to wrestle with all the time on the advisory board, right? Of like, who's your core audience? Like this is the thing that organizations have to face. And I think it's confusing if organizations don't choose. Maybe it's the difference between organizations making choices or individuals making choices.
I think so, but for me, it's also connected with where we are in the life cycle of the field and the movement, because I think as things become, as that ball of wool picks up momentum and brings on other people, you still need those entry points for folks that are at different stages off their journey.
So then as I heard you say that, it maybe suggests it doesn't change over time, right? Like at any moment in a field, you need somebody who's tending to the newcomers and somebody who's tending to the people who have been in the field for a long time, right? I think there was a big debate this divide at the last Gender Smart conference seemed like it was stuck between the, we have to welcome the new people and make it accessible for people who have never been in this conversation. And the conference is designed for people who are deep in this conversation. And please don't bore me with the 101 version one more time, because I really don't need to debate definition of gender lens investing. I think the answer there is we shouldn't spend any time, I believe, we shouldn't spend any time debating which one of those is right. The answer is yes. Both. All the time.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. And for me, it starts to also be about, segmentation, more explicit segmentation. and acknowledging that there is, there will be no one perfect way, and that we each need to sort of co-construct what's going to work for the type of thesis, the type of strategy that you are taking forward. And yeah, it's not about, you know, only one way being the best way, so to speak. And ultimately, I think, you know, for me, sometimes what I will do is I'll go back to that original sort of grounding of gender lens investing and gender analysis, which is about power analysis. And if that is missing in the design all the way through post-investment support of any kind of strategy, that helps me then like kind of sense check, okay, where is this thing really? What else does it have to do? What are some of the tools? What are some of the conversations that this particular initiative can take to really take that next step?
So Susanna, that just struck me in such a cool way. It just hit me that sometimes where I get frustrated is when people who have chosen to work with the mainstream audience and they've decided that the simplified messages and the data points that are straightforward and mainstream. And I agree with all of that. Like, I think we should promote women on boards. We should focus. Like, all of those are good strategies. They're not the only strategy, but they're good strategies. But what you just said reminded me, the challenge is when the people who are working in the mainstream stop doing the power analysis. Because just because you're working in the mainstream doesn't mean you shouldn't be aware of the power dynamics. You can be aware of what's going on and then choose to simplify the messages. It's when the mainstream story, the people who are working to support a mainstream narrative, haven't analyzed the unintended consequences, the complexity. And I'm not saying you know those things and you still choose to do the same thing because it's still right. But if you're not willing to analyze it and say, is my approach to the mainstream the approach that is going to have the least unintended consequences? Or am I shutting down other potentials? Like, I just think it's the way you named that is like, in the end, we have to keep doing an analysis. And I think sometimes the folks who have chosen the more mainstream pathway, because the mainstream pathway is not simple. It's really hard, and it requires the same level of analysis that doing a deeper dive does.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, finance is a complex subject. It's full of different complex principles. But here's where, for me, I think if you're on the journey of affecting more systemic change in finance, it's only by that deeper conversation and that deeper analysis that we can start to think about reframing some of the underpinning principles of finance, how risk is constructed, how value is constructed. And that's why I think, shameless plug for Criterion's toolkit, I think the fact that it's based on financial process, and when you're in that sort of deep dive workshop with others, you get to like really question some of the assumptions that you've built around a financial product or a thing that you're doing. And so this is also where I think it's coupled with the power of possibility and imagination and just believing like, hey, this could work in a different way. And these are some lines of inquiry that, you know, might be, because the frustration I have is that the money isn't moving in the quantum. It's not just about scale, but it's how can we possibly be stuck at some of those same numbers, you know, 2% of venture capital, and everybody doesn't need venture capital, but still it's 2%. 1.3% assets under management by diverse minority fund manager. Those are just such small numbers, and I'm not asking them to be like, it just needs to be more representative of the society that we live in. And so how do we move the, and the mainstream is part of moving the quantum.
I don't know, I'm just so struck by this in the conversation about, you know, I think the mainstream strategies can also get stuck. Mainstream strategies can also get stale. And maybe the mainstream strategies that we thought were going to work aren't. Or the mainstream strategies are incremental and the time frame's just off, right? We are under-resourced and significantly behind the climate conversation. So I often get frustrated that, like, why didn't we get faster? I was like, well, look how many resources the climate world had compared to the gender world. And there's a lot of reasons we're not as far. But really continuing to assess whoever you're trying to convince, making sure you're continually checking. What are your assumptions about the audience? What are your analysis of the power dynamics? Where do we need to be shifting norms? Because if we operate within the same norms, we're actually never going to make progress. And so how do we think through those different choices more carefully? Yeah.
Absolutely. And also how do we have those kinds of conversations with people who don't even know how to name things like a power analysis in finance? Like what is the language? And this is why I think the role of translators as Criterion has been working for so long. It plays such an essential role in building those bridges, because it helps to value knowledge in such a different way. And then, there's much to be done, I think, in terms of how we speak about this as well and how we frame things.
Yeah, and I think I want to make sure that the people who are working in a mainstream audience, many of them, they have the same smarts. They have to do an extraordinarily complex analysis to be able to work inside of the system. And I think sometimes when people who don't really understand gender or don't really understand power choose a more mainstream approach because they didn't understand the alternative and they don't really understand what they're doing, that's where we end up with a bad name. That's where we're really talking about pinkwashing, greenwashing, whatever you want to call it. But there are people, and you and I are friends with so many of them, you know, who are working inside of big, complex systems, who are brilliantly navigating the power dynamics, are aware of them, know that they're complicit in the system, have figured out all of those things, and chose to stay in the system. So maybe it's not the in the system, out of the system, but making sure that you're actually aware of where you are all the time and that you're still assessing.
And the point that you brought about the time scale. It's some of these things are incremental. We don't see them right away. Someone brought up recently, like, the holographic aspect of change. And so being okay that things are shifting now, but these tiny ripples are creating a different pathway of change that I can't see yet, I can't feel yet, but it's not like it's just going off into a void in a vacuum, right? So hope comes to mind for me here too, that we have to keep our hope and resilience in the face of this, challenging but enjoyable work.
On that note. I want to talk about the cost of excitement. kind of an interesting phrase that we've been playing with for a while. And so working in early stage fields, early stage markets where things haven't necessarily gelled, one of the things that you do is you go gin up excitement. You give speeches, you throw out possibilities, and you say, let's go do this. Let's build something new. Let's invest with a gender lens. Let's figure out new approaches to imagine if you could invest to make a difference on gender-based violence. There's been, you know, throughout all of this, there's sort of so much of what is needed is to throw out a new set of possibilities. And then came TED Talks. And there was this formula in TED Talks that you got caught, you know, over the last, 10 years or so, the number of times that I've been asked to give a TED-like talk, which needs to end with three simple steps, because the need is to throw out a possibility, but then that's not good enough. Because if you don't leave people with three simple steps that they can take, then what's the point of getting them excited? So I've thought about this a lot, which is just because I got you excited, I'm not responsible for where that goes. I'm actually not responsible if I get you excited about something to play out that fulfillment. You can take that broader comment wherever you want to, but there's a clear sense of why can't we say, here's what's possible, but frankly, we don't know how to do it yet. I want to ask this question, but I don't know what the answer is. I want to name that I think there's a glimmer of hope of a possibility, but I haven't gotten it worked out at all, let alone enough to be able to give you three simple steps. And on top of it, it's often people who sit in positions of privilege who are demanding those steps. Well, if you want me to invest, give me the three places that I can now invest. Like, bloody hell, there isn't any place you can invest yet. I'm saying what's possible. How about if you use your power to push people to do this? Why am I responsible for the follow through as well as the idea? So part of the cautionary tale here is we can have broader conversations. We can throw out ideas before they're fully baked. We can name possibilities and collectively ask people to join with us in using their power as well to figure out how to make this happen. We don't always have to pay the cost of somebody else's excitement to say, if you're excited, I have to do all the work to follow through to make sure you can take the next steps. I can have just said, wouldn't this be cool?
To learn more about our work, visit us at criterioninstitute.org. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Your reviews help our podcast reach a wider audience. Thanks for listening.